You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Obama and Governor Romney have both championed the revival of American manufacturing, a goal that in the last decade has proved elusive as that sector has steadily lost millions of jobs to China and elsewhere. Ro Khanna, however, sees the revival is already here, and he believes the U.S. manufacturing sector is stronger than it has ever been and is set to regain its top spot in the manufacturing global front if it enacts creative policies going forward. Mr. Khanna, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Commerce for the Obama Administration, has written a book called Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. It's published by McGraw-Hill. I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Most everything we've heard about manufacturing indicates that the U.S. has lost a lot of ground, upwards of 5 million factory jobs that have been lost since the year 2000. Are you really saying that the manufacturing sector is stronger than it's ever been?
Well, that's absolutely correct, that we have lost 5 to 6 million jobs from 2000 to 2010. But one of the things that's overlooked is we still are a leader when it comes to manufacturing output. We're neck and neck with China. We make about 20% of the world's goods. China makes about 20% of the world's goods. We do that with 10% of our economy. China does that with 40% of its economy, and we have this incredible productivity advantage in the United States.
Has outsourcing been the main cause of manufacturing job losses? Because Robert Rice says 5 million of those jobs are never coming back.
Some of those jobs aren't coming back, and I think it's outsourcing, but I also think it's automation. There has been a lot of technology used in these factories that have eliminated some of the jobs.
But yeah, I've read that labor costs make up about 10% of the total cost of a product, which isn't a lot. So why have we even seen any outsourcing of this sort? Is it because manufacturers want to be in places where they don't have to deal with unions?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct to point out that it's only about 10%, but other countries are doing more than just providing cheaper labor. Countries are providing sometimes free land, free rent, access to capital. Some companies get instantaneous permits when they go offshore. And so I think to compete, we need to recognize what other nations are doing for their manufacturing.
But we've been doing it ourselves. The New England lost all the textile industry to the South when southern states did pretty much the same thing you're describing that China's doing.
Well, I wouldn't. I don't think we would go as far as China. I mean, with the currency manipulation and some of the gross subsidies. But the point is, since Alexander Hamilton in 1791, there was the American economic system where we thought that government should have a role in supporting the private sector and supporting manufacturers, whether that was through tax incentives or providing strategic assistance. And there was a bipartisan consensus in this country about that, which has recently eroded, I'd say, over the last 30 years. And other countries, frankly, are copying the American economic system, which made us an industrial power.
Perhaps we should define the word manufacturing. We usually associate it with factory jobs, but you say it encompasses a lot more.
Absolutely. This is one of the things where I respectfully disagree with Robert Reich, where he makes this distinction between manufacturing jobs, which he describes largely as repetitive, and knowledge jobs. And if my experience, having visited dozens of American factories, is that manufacturing jobs are knowledge jobs. Today's manufacturing jobs require operating sophisticated equipment, require understanding of lean manufacturing principles, how to be most efficient, operating CNC machines. Every job is repetitive. I mean, my legal training, as a lawyer, you cut and paste documents. Every job has repetitive aspects, but manufacturing jobs today require extraordinary creativity and innovation.
So why has Apple sent most of its manufacturing jobs to China?
Well, first off, Apple has its prototype manufacturing still in the United States. So it's very difficult to separate design and production for inventing a new iPhone or inventing a new product. What they have sent offshore is a lot of the mass production and to Foxconn. Now, Tim Cook has talked about looking at bringing some of that manufacturing back, and a number of companies such as GE have realized that offshoring may not make economic sense, given the decline in quality, given transportation costs, given now increasing wages in China. But in Apple's particular case, the challenge is doing the prototype manufacturing here makes sense, and how do you justify the mass manufacturing? And that's going to be a challenge for our country.
Where did the mess up on the new iPhone's map come from? Here or there?
Well, I don't know about that. That you'll have to ask someone from Apple.
If you look at the thriving tech sector, Google, Facebook, Twitter, they aren't real big job creators.
They're not a panacea. I mean, I don't think you can say that social media or the internet is going to solve our unemployment problem. That said, I think they do play an enormous role. And one of the biggest benefits to them is that they're spreading American ideals. I mean, if you look at our country's founding, freedom of speech, freedom of debate, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, that's what these companies stand for. And I think in that way, they're playing a very constructive role.
Well, you said that the United States and China pretty much produce equally. Actually, China knocked the United States off the top position globally in manufacturing output last year.
They did.
And the United States had held that position for 110 years.
Yes, they did.
If you compare the manufacturing base of both countries, how did they differ?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. We lost the lead in 2010. In fact, I had to revise the proofs of the book and put that in there because we had held the lead. But the reality is we still are neck and neck, and we're doing it with 10% of our economy. China is doing it with 40% of its economy. It's a staggering. We have a 6 times the productivity. And if you look at what we do well, it's advanced equipment, advanced manufacturing. China does consumer goods, some of the lower-end manufacturing.
But that's a temporary situation. China is really catching up with the rest of the world right now. So yesterday we were talking about how India only has 5% growth rate, which the United States would be thrilled to have. But India is starting at a much bottom position.
Right.
So 5% is a lot, but it really doesn't mean all that much. The same is true for China, isn't it? Someday China is going to wind up being a lot closer to the United States, and then we're going to have to deal with the fact that we're still not competing favorably.
Well, there's no question that China's growth rates are faster than ours in manufacturing. If it weren't, we wouldn't need to do anything. We could just rest on our laurels. But you look at where we have specific advantages. Consider steel. Now, China produces about 500 tons of steel, more than we do, but they have a domestic market of 600 million tons. We produce about 80% of our steel for the domestic market in the United States. And we produce a ton of steel with 0.25 labor hours. It takes a Chinese worker about 12 hours to produce that same ton of steel. So where we can compete is to be the most innovative, the most efficient, and at the higher end. Does this mean that China is going to continue to grow? Absolutely. But if we're at the higher end, if we're innovative, that competition can bring out the best in our manufacturers.
My guest is Ro Khanna, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce, and now a visiting lecturer at the Department of Economics at Stanford University. His book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. You mentioned the fact that much of our steel goes to domestic consumption. And one of the things that you talk about a lot in this book is about export and the need for us to export more. And as I understand it, when the dollar is weak, it's easier to export. And yet the dollar is weak, and we're not improving our export position.
Well, actually, exports have grown. The president, as you know, had a national export initiative to double exports over the next 5 years. And the last 2 years, I think exports have been up around 17 to 20%. So we have seen some growth in our exports. China, of course, with the currency manipulation is a huge issue that's hurting our exports. But it's also a cultural issue. I mean, for the longest time, American companies were satisfied selling to the domestic market because most of the consumers were here. Now 95% of the world's consumers are overseas.
One of the companies you profile is called Pucker Powder. It's quite active in foreign markets. It's a candy?
It is.
Why do you suppose they were able to tap into the overseas market so easily?
Well, they're a great example if you can do this from anywhere. They're based in Alabama. And they had owners who really made it a priority to go overseas. They participated in trade shows. They participated in trade missions and trade fairs. They displayed their goods at these fairs. And They really made an effort to have international business.
Steve Hindy of Brooklyn Brewery told me that his company is the largest exporter of beer into Sweden.
That's interesting.
He thinks it's about branding as much as anything else. Brooklyn having a special kind of cachet now. But I guess it can be done if you find the right market.
It certainly can be done. There's still a huge cachet to having something made in America. I mean, people around the world want that. Our popular culture has a branding and a cachet. And I think niche products in particular have an opportunity. But it requires a serious amount of effort, engagement, and time. And it can't be an afterthought.
Well, one of the problems with Made in America is that consumers in other countries aren't always aware that the product that they're buying, the American product, like at the Gap or Levi Jeans, who actually made somewhere else.
Well, there are criteria, I think, to get the Made in America label. I don't know exactly, but I think it requires over 51% domestic content. And certainly we should have strict requirements so that the labeling is accurate. But the reality is people still associate Made in America with quality, with ingenuity. And other countries, by restricting access to American goods, are really hurting the standard of living of their own citizens.
Well, isn't another problem that American manufacturers have been quite comfortable just focusing on the domestic market?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that for the longest time there's been this view that if you sell within the United States, that's sufficient. And people have had an international department sort of as an afterthought and saying, okay, if we get a couple international sales, great. But there hasn't been an aggressive strategy. Only 1% of American companies currently export. And it's difficult. It requires a cultural familiarity, a language familiarity, effort to make a lot of foreign trips. But one of the advantages a country has is our extraordinary diversity, and that should give us a competitive edge in a global economy.
Ro Khanna is my guest, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. His book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future, it's published by McGraw-Hill. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ro Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce in the Obama administration, now a visiting lecturer in the Department of Economics at Stanford University, and a technology attorney at Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati. His book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future, it is published by McGraw-Hill. When you were Deputy Assistant Secretary of at the U.S. Department of Commerce, you spent considerable time traveling and meeting with small to mid-sized manufacturing companies. One of them, Vitamix, manufactures blenders for Starbucks and also for people at home, although it's an expensive product. Can you tell us about them?
It was one of my favorite companies to visit. Anyone who's orders a Frappuccino at some of these specialty coffee shops would be surprised to know that the blenders making those Frappuccinos are made by Starbucks in the United States. And when I first found that out, I thought, this is why I'm paying $4 for my coffee. But it turns out that Vitamix actually did a fantastic job in customizing these blenders to make sure that there are no lingering ice chips, to make sure that when they're at Barnes & Noble's, these blenders aren't making enough noise and customers can enjoy their coffee and read. And so what the Vitamix example shows is that if a product is customized to meet a specific need, it often has great demand and can be made in the United States.
And they also last longer than many of the competitors. But we're talking about a fairly small company. It's not like General Electric. So companies like this, it's nice if they succeed, but it's really not going to change the economic outlook of this country, is it?
Well, half the manufacturing jobs are created by small and medium-sized manufacturers. Of the about 11 million manufacturing jobs that we have, 6 million are by companies like Vitamix, companies with less than 500 employees. And so I think often our policymakers ignore how central small and medium-sized manufacturers are. And frankly, they need government assistance more than a GE or the big companies, which can hire consultants or experts to help them get overseas or help them be competitive.
And that's been part of the Romney campaign. He's been bringing small manufacturers out on when he has been speaking to say, you know, they're not getting the kind of support they should be getting from Washington.
Well, I think that may be a bit disingenuous. Mitt Romney may be bringing them out to campaign rallies. The question is, what are his policies? I mean, the policies of the Republican Congress have been cutting programs such as the Manufacturing Extension Partnership that specifically helps small and medium-sized manufacturers, cutting the programs in the Commerce Department. When Rick Perry had called for the elimination of the Commerce Department, most of those programs help small and medium-sized manufacturers. So I think if Governor Romney is serious about it, he should articulate what programs he would support.
But the public perception is that that Washington is supporting the companies that are too big to fail. And there was the auto bailout, which definitely did not involve small companies, although small companies do gain because they manufacture stuff for General Motors and for Chrysler.
Absolutely.
But still, the focus seems to have been on the big guys.
I think that is a fair criticism on both parties, that we could do more to have voices of small and medium-sized businesses and more focused on the programs helping them, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, the U.S. Foreign Commercial Service that helps small and medium-sized businesses export, programs that are helping them make it more competitive. But it has been the Republican Congress that has been calling for drastic budget cuts in these programs, some of these programs which were started by Republican presidents.
Now, we talked about increasing exports, but that is a problem in this depressed global economy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you're saying that countries around the world...
Spain isn't about to start buying American products cheap or expensive.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is where our economy is interlinked. I mean, of course, you need the demand for products to be high to be able to export. And this is why the American economy is interlinked with the success of other economies.
What needs to happen for the larger corporations to begin bringing some of the manufacturing back home?
GE is a great example in Louisville, where they brought washers and dishwashers that were being made in China back to the industrial park in Louisville. And it was a combination of the right tax incentives, a combination of unions sitting down with management and saying, how can we make a competitive wage that's a win-win, and a combination of a study of the metrics. The management team looked at the customer service calls that were happening when things were made in China and studied that versus the customer service calls far less that were happening when the product was made in the U.S.
Governor Romney is saying we should be a little harder on China. Should we insist that other countries engage in fair trade policies and economic fairness?
Absolutely we should. The question is, how do you get there? Does China have policies on currency manipulation, on subsidies to elite exporters that are hurting American workers and hurting their own middle class? Absolutely. Paul Krugman makes that argument. The question is, though, how are you going to inspire change there? And I think it requires a complex foreign policy approach and not just sloganeering.
According to WTO laws, we're not allowed to exempt our manufacturers from taxes like the value-added tax. But that's not true of other countries. So there are international rules that hurt us.
This was one of the most surprising things I just found out when I was researching this book. And it's staggering that we set up these rules after the World War II. And other countries, if they have a value-added tax, can provide an export tax credit. We, because we have a corporate tax, can't do that. We never thought that other countries would ever be that competitive. We wanted to encourage their exports after World War II. And now we're stuck with these rules that are really archaic. And certainly reforming those rules to reflect the contemporary reality should be a bipartisan priority.
A listener asks on our show page, what percentage of U.S. manufacturing is linked to weapons manufacture? Since most weapons contracts are dispersed among all 50 states, eliminating one particular system impacts several states simultaneously.
The observer is correct about that, and it's about 10 to 15% is defense manufacturing. It's a very small part of our exports, though. I mean, people often think, you know, America just sells weapons to the world, and that's actually not true. We're not weapons exports are about $22 billion a year, which are not even in the top 10. It's about 10% of our manufacturing base and a critical part of our manufacturing base, but it's certainly not all that we do.
You support corporate tax breaks, but at a time when our country is so deeply divided over issues of inequality and tax fairness, how would a corporate tax break sit with the middle and lower income classes?
Well, I don't support corporate tax breaks that aren't targeted and that aren't linked to employment. And so I think we should have tax breaks for depreciation of equipment. The president had a temporary tax credit. I think that should be made permanent. I think we should look at companies that are investing in factories, saying revenue coming from that factory should have a tax holiday for a number of years. I think if companies are bringing back money offshore and investing that in expanding the payroll, I'm for giving tax credits. So tax credits with accountability, and we have to do that to be competitive given what other countries are doing for their manufacturers.
But haven't a number of major corporations been reported to pay no taxes despite huge earnings?
Yes, and that's a problem, but I don't think that's many of the small and medium-sized manufacturers or many of the large manufacturers. If there's just an across-the-board corporate tax cut, that, I think, can be subject to further abuse or lowering the fair share on companies. But if the tax credits are targeted to companies that are producing new factories and creating new jobs, then I think it's a worthwhile incentive.
My guest is Ro Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. His book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future, is published by McGraw-Hill. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So in this book, you propose two different tax policies.
Yes.
A lower tax rate for repatriation of money on the condition it's invested in capital equipment and workforce, and tax credits for companies that bring manufacturing back home.
Absolutely.
It would be a two-tier system?
It would be two aspects of reforming the corporate tax code. Right now, there are a lot of companies that have their money offshore in China, in Brazil, in India. And to bring that money back, they have to pay the U.S. tax rate, corporate tax rate, and many of them don't want to pay that. Now, in 2004, we allowed them a one-day repatriation tax holiday. Companies brought it back, and most of that money went to the shareholders. It wasn't clear whether it created new jobs. So what I'm saying is let's have a compromise. Let's allow these companies to bring that money back. But let's have them expand their payroll and show something that it's actually helping the middle class.
Well, there's another side to this. Because of improved technology and robotics, we've eliminated many of our jobs in this country for good. It doesn't matter whether we've shipped them overseas or not.
We have. But I am not of the view that automation is going to somehow render the workforce unnecessary. I mean, John Maynard Keynes wrote this famous article in the 1930s saying because of technology, all of us would have 15-hour work weeks. That didn't work out that way because we always have demand for new products. John Maynard Keynes would never have thought that human beings would need iPhones or would need the type of television sets that we have. And so the expanding basket of goods allows us to expand the workforce even with automation. And the challenge is how do we prepare a workforce to have the skills to be operating the machines that will be required for the jobs of the future.
But isn't there also a problem of projecting into the future? For example, 10 years ago, it looked like computer manufacturers were going to just continue to boom, and now suddenly they've hit a wall. The people who make the chips for the computers have hit a wall. We can go on to people buying fewer television sets because the television sets they bought a few years ago were already quite advanced. So a company like Xerox, which was a major corporation 25 years ago, I don't even know if it exists anymore. The world changes so quickly. How can you really prepare for all of those changes?
Well, I think the advice in the famous movie The Graduate go into plastics, that's no longer applicable in today's world. You can't predict and say go into a specific industry. I think what is more necessary is for people to acquire the skills to be lifelong learners, to be creative with their careers, to understand they're going to have 7 to 8 jobs. I mean, my father worked for the same company for 30 years and then retired. That's no longer possible in this world, and it's going to mean that we expect more from our workforce.
And American companies are complaining that they do have jobs, but they can't find people who are qualified to fill them.
Well, that's a bit
so
of
a... Is this really a matter of educational policy as well?
I think educational policy has to be part of it. I mean, there's no doubt that there are certain jobs that are high skill that we don't have the right people with the right skill set for. And that means investing in community colleges to have the right type of training programs, investing in unions that are providing skill trades and apprenticeship programs, and making sure in K through 12 that we're teaching people the right types of science and math that are going to be required. But it's false to say it's just a skills gap problem. I mean, there's also a consumer demand problem. We don't have people buying enough stuff to have companies growing. And this is Krugman's point that, you know, we have to get the economy moving as well and to create jobs.
You mentioned investing in unions. Well, right now aren't unions being portrayed, even in a movie that just opened today, as the bad guys, the people who are causing all the problems in our economy?
Well, I think that just reflects a lack of appreciation of a lot of the contemporary unions and what they're doing. I mean, a lot of unions are frankly working with companies to identify skilled positions and saying, look, we will provide you the best quality. We will help train people for these jobs where you are having a tough time finding positions. And we will help make sure that we're filling the type of positions you need. And one of the interesting facts is a lot of private companies are eager to have union labor because they want that to be done well. And it's often the public sector that doesn't go with the building trades or other union jobs.
But it's my sense that the outsourcing goes all the way back to when unionized companies moved to right-to-work states. And then when those places unionized, then they moved to China or Vietnam or South Korea. Or Mexico now. Mexico is seeing a major resurgence, isn't it?
Well, let me answer the first question first. The race to the bottom, I don't think, is a way that America is going to remain competitive in the manufacturing space. And I think companies that have offshored just to save on that 10% of labor cost are realizing that there are a lot of things they overlooked, transportation costs, eventual rising wages in the areas they move to, and lack of quality, and also separating design from production, delays in production launch. So I think the metrics of outsourcing are changing, and companies are taking a hard look at that. In terms of Mexico, I mean, of course, they have the maquiladoras, which do some manufacturing and then work in partnership with some American manufacturing to do some of the assembly there and do manufacturing here. If it's done in a way that's fair trade, that's fine. If it's done under exploitive conditions, that's problematic.
A listener wants to know, what are the reasons for the resurgence of manufacturing in the U.S.? Is it due mainly to market forces, or did government play a role? And can one political party claim to be better for manufacturing than the other?
I think the government played a role certainly in, and if I give the president credit for one thing, it's in saying, look, we still need a manufacturing base in this country.
Did the stimulus package help at all?
I think you could make a case that the stimulus package, by increasing consumer demand, helped manufacturers in this country. But the president stood up at the State of the Union and said, all these people who are saying, let's just move to a service economy, are wrong. America needs a manufacturing base. And that used to be a bipartisan consensus. So Can one political party claim credit? Certainly not historically. Historically, you can give Hamilton, Jefferson, Lincoln, Hoover, and even Reagan some credit for the manufacturing base in different industries. But what has happened recently is you have some people on the far right saying, we don't want government to intervene at all. And this is contrary to a history in this country of a bipartisan a view of that government has a role to play.
And this leads us to something you address in your book, the story of Solyndra, the green tech company that received a $535 million Energy Department loan guarantee and then wound up filing for bankruptcy.
The story, though, that's not told about Solyndra, whatever else one's view of the Department of Energy's loan, is the role the Chinese dumping of solar panels played. I mean, when Solyndra received that loan, the Chinese price was not as low. The price of Chinese solar power panels fell, and they started dumping that into the United States, and Solyndra was unable to compete. And there was also inept management there where they were scaling up their factories before they had the demand to do so. Now, it is a reasonable debate whether government should fund specific companies, and people of goodwill can disagree. What is not should not be a debate is whether our government should invest in a educated workforce, whether our government should invest in national laboratories doing technological research, whether our government should invest in programs to help small and medium-sized manufacturers compete and export, whether our government should invest in places like ARPA-E and DARPA that are helping us be the most innovative. These were things that leaders of both parties said would build a great America. And that bipartisan consensus today is under threat.
During your tenure at the Department of Commerce, what were you able to accomplish in a way of rebuilding the manufacturing sector?
Well, one of the things I learned in Washington is your accomplishments are often discreet and I would certainly not claim lofty credit for rebuilding America's manufacturing sector. And most of that belongs to the hardworking men and women who are actually creating the economy. The things, though, that we were able to accomplish, you know, one of the things I'm proudest of is we brought a metrics approach to how the Department of Commerce operated. So before that, people would just allocate resources in states and offices wherever a congressperson or senator wanted those resources. And we said, let's look actually at the return on investment. Is a person allocated in California or New York, what is the return on investment in terms of the increase in manufacturing capacity or exports? And let's make allocative decisions based on that. So I think bringing some of those common sense business practices to how these government agencies ran would be one of the accomplishments I'm proudest of.
How much of a role should the federal government play as opposed to state governments? Because they're both involved in a bit of a tug of war, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, I think the federal government needs to set some of the tax policies, simplifying the regulatory environment, not lowering regulations, but simplifying the bureaucracy around it. Those are federal prerogatives, and the federal government has to do that, and on trade. But the state governments also have a role to play. Some of the most cumbersome regulations are local and state regulations that companies have to deal with. And if there are ways that the state government can partner with local governments to make a one-stop shop, that would be very helpful.
Your title is Entrepreneurial Nation. Now, there are other countries that have been entrepreneurial. Do you think the United States is more than Germany or France or China?
I do. Japan? I do. My thesis in the book is that our productivity advantage, which is up there, we're more productive than China, Germany, or Japan, is due to an entrepreneurial culture. And by that, I don't mean just the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Sergey Brins or Bill Gates who are brilliant and found companies. By that, I mean that our democratic culture suffuses a lot of our best businesses. They listen to the ideas of ordinary employees. They encourage ordinary employees to question authority, to think outside the box. And this open environment of challenging authority, of thinking out of the box, of valuing the contributions of everyday workers. It represents American entrepreneurialism at its best. And certainly I haven't spent time in every other country, but it strikes me that this is one of our comparative advantages.
Going forward, how should we be measuring manufacturing success?
My sense is we need to look, of course, at our total output and see if that can, hopefully we can regain the lead, and that 1 year was an aberration with China being ahead. But also we need to look at what is the output per worker. And if we're remaining even in the same ballpark with China with 10 million workers, whereas China has 100 million manufacturing workers, that's pretty good. So let's see, can our productivity stay high? Can our manufacturing output continue to grow? And then finally, are we at least stabilizing a manufacturing workforce? Right now, we have about 11 million people in manufacturing jobs. They're good paying jobs. We want to make sure that we keep these. And as the president's goal is to increase a million more over the next 4 years. And regardless of the outcome of the election in terms of who wins the presidency, the Senate and the House, I hope that will be a bipartisan goal.
I hear that you're thinking of running for the House of Representatives.
Well, right now I'm here with the book and focused on that. But certainly I think that politics is still an important calling. Most people go there.
You want to go back to Washington?
You know, the big issues at some point are in Washington. The big issues of what do we do on trade? What do we do on tax policy? What do we do on education policy? And we still are the greatest democracy in the world, and it was the greatest privilege to be part of that process.
Just one more thing. If you do run, you would be running from California's 15th district. Now, California right now is going through a really rough time. It was one of the manufacturing centers of the United States. What happened?
Well, it still has a strong manufacturing base, and Silicon Valley is the third largest manufacturing center. But, you know, I think California invested strongly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in education and in infrastructure. We went away from some of those investments, and we need to have the right regulatory challenges on companies with the Byzantine agencies that they have to go through need to be simplified. So I think the state certainly can do a better job as well.
Ro Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. His book, Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future. It is published by McGraw-Hill. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.